Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, a reminder that we're Zooming this show on Sunday afternoon, so something should happen Sunday night. We will not be discussing it, but a lot happened on Sunday, so I think there'll be a lot to talk about even around 4 o'clock on that very day. As you've come to expect, we begin our show every single day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. More than ever, I think I wanted people to understand what the voice of a patriot sounded like. And he truly is the voice of a patriot. We lost another patriot just about a week ago, and that's John Lewis. But we'll get to him next. Now, the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So if it's Monday, it's our Rethink the Week. And we always have an interesting panel of guests. Our kind of anchor is Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He also has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. And you can hear him regularly on New Hampshire Public Radio. Welcome to the program, Dean.
Hi, Ernie. Good to be with you.
We then go, I'm going to do you last, Val. We then go to Rick Newman, and Rick Newman is an old friend. He was a former state legislator. He is currently a lobbyist, a very effective lobbyist. He lobbies for a lot of organizations that I usually were fighting over the years, but I always love his mind. I always love how he thinks, and he always brings interesting content to the table. So Rick, despite the fact that you work for beer, booze, butts, whatever it is that you're lobbying for, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Arnie. Person, woman, man, camera, TV. I just wanted to show him this guy.
Oh my God.
Running the country.
It was such a hard test. How did you do that?
It's tougher. And not very many people can do it in order.
Can I just say one thing before we move on?
Yeah.
What's so funny about that is the actual real test, the words are not supposed to be related in any way. So he managed to pick a bunch of words. You got, you know, person and man and woman all related, and then camera and TV are related, so didn't even get that right.
Oh God!
Well,
thank you so much.
Completely unrelated.
Thank you so much for that point of information. See how we begin the show. Thank you, Donald Trump. Anyway, and last but clearly not least is Val Endritz. She is a professor at Rhode Island College, a professor of communications. And I really wanted to talk to Val this Sunday afternoon as we then hear it on Monday for our Rethink the Week for a number of reasons. But Val, before I sort of grab you for why I was so happy that you said yes to the show today, is that... So I'm watching John Lewis, and I'm watching the casket go across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. I'm watching the rose petals. I'm listening to the music. I'm just in awe. I'm just in awe. And I want to comment about something that happened last week. So on our last Rethink the Week, we had a fellow by the name of Glenn Smith. And Glenn Smith is a Texan. He is a very liberal, progressive Texan, and he actually ran Ann Richards' first campaign for governor. So you know how long he's been doing this, and he was a reporter. He has a lot of political history in the state of Texas. And we were commenting about John Lewis because John had just died that Friday before. And he said, you know who John Lewis is? He's our political Buddha. That he is just so stable and so kind and just... He's kind of this reliable person for being the conscience of our politics and of the Congress. And as I was going through some of the quotes of John Lewis, Val, I suddenly realized I'm not sure political Buddha was the right one. I think Moses is. And I think because he understood better than anyone, and maybe the fact that his casket is going over that bridge, is that like Moses, you want to lead the people to the promised land, but you yourself don't get there. But that's okay. That's okay. And he actually has a number of quotes where he's telling people that they have to fight the fight, but that even as they fight the fight, they may not live to see the success. But that's not a reason not to fight the fight. And as I was reading some of his quotes, you know, good trouble, I remember telling women that they needed to run for office. And I was a two-time loser. And here I am begging them, encouraging them to run. And I reminded them that most of us that will run will lose. But that's not a reason not to run. And I invited them into the political process because I thought it was just so important that that is part of the process. It's nice to think about the winning, but you have to be there, win or lose. So that's sort of my thoughts about John Lewis. But the reason I sort of mentioned about running and losing is because I see a real winner also this week. And the real winner who got to Congress, the place I wanted to go to but never got to, was AOC. And Val, AOC took to the floor of Congress on Thursday and blew my socks off. Because in a lot of ways, she framed a response to Congressman Yoho, who had called her every kind of name we could possibly imagine and then lied on the floor the day before when he was supposedly giving an apology. And she managed to craft an answer and a response to him that was so much bigger than the moment that every woman I know was like, we were all calling each other up going, oh my God, because you don't have to be in politics to understand what she was saying to him. So I'm kind of curious as to your response to her powerful, powerful talk on Thursday. A little backstory for everyone. So, you know, Yoho made this statement as he was walking down the steps of Congress, and supposedly he didn't necessarily direct it at her, but it was sort of a theatrical whisper that everybody could hear, reporters, her, the guy walking with him, and it was intentional. I mean, you know, you don't have to spit at someone to feel the wet on your cheek. And then he gets up on the day before on Wednesday and basically kind of lies and says, I didn't say it. And then he reminds everyone, and of course I wouldn't do something like this. I have wives. I have a wife. I have daughters. As if somehow that was his, you know, fig leaf or whatever possibly could have been wrong. And then, of course, she takes to the floor. And I think a lot of us were just very, very, not only proud of her, but she spoke for us. So, Val, when I mentioned that I was glad as a point of personal privilege that I wanted to start here, you said you wanted to comment, but you also wanted to comment on the media's response. So since you do political communications and you have that sensitivity to hearing what they say, I was just too enthralled to even care what they said because I knew what I was thinking. But, Val, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Arnie. And I agree with you. She's an amazing orator, and I've listened to some of her campaign speeches that she gave in New York and in the Bronx. And she is probably one of the best extemporaneous speakers who's out there. And if you remember, she didn't have a manuscript. This was from her head and also from her heart. And in many ways, she reminds me of Barack Obama, that defining moment during the Democratic National Convention, where everybody was looking at him and wondering who he was. And she did that, and she was able to do that, not with great ceremony, because this wasn't the kind of speech, but still be able to give a very principled response that will outlast the moment. And that's what I think is really important. Now, on the other hand, I read a number of the media responses, and of course, the New York Times took a hit on their response to AOC's speech. And there in most of the accounts, they were looking at the issue of political capital. And again, what rears its ugly head here is the ambition of women. And women, how dare you achieve something? And so you know, what happened was the response to male incivility, and that's a very egregious account of male incivility. They made the focus on AOC rather than on the incivility itself. Oh yeah,
she spoke and, for all of us, and it wasn't yes. political. It was so much more global yes. than that.
And I'm thinking, if we had the media that we deserve, what we would have is calls for investigations in Congress about bullying and intimidation of women in the Capitol.
Wow.
And Nancy Pelosi has
Write that op-ed, Val. No, I'm serious. Keep going.
And Nancy Pelosi has talked about this repeatedly, that this has happened to her, that it happens to other women. And what AOC was trying to say is that, you know, if it weren't for her strength, she would have been bullied and intimidated as well. And the whole idea is to make women shut up. And not to speak their mind and not to achieve leadership positions. And so what I really wanted to see is this personal violation be a larger issue, as AOC had implied in her speech.
Exactly.
That what we need to do is to look at this issue, not only in the halls of Congress where women are imbued with quite a bit of power, but also, as you said, Arnie, in the workplace, and at every place else. I don't know a woman who couldn't identify with what she said.
And Rick, you made an interesting point before you came on the air. And you said there's also something, so she does have an amazing personal character. And it's not something that was groomed, Rick, as you point out, in politics. She comes from a working class experience. Mm-hmm. She comes from a place, and as you mentioned, where did she work before she got so incredibly political? Was a place, if it doesn't toughen up your spine, blah, 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 you're out of here, because you have to be able to not only withstand a lot of grief, you have to be able to dish it out as well, Rick.
A woman working in a bar in Milford, New Hampshire has got to be tough. I can't imagine how tough you are, a woman working in a bar in Brooklyn.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not putting down the job at all. I totally get that. She came from a working class background, and it happens to be a job where women are subjected to all kinds of, you know, inappropriate comments on a daily basis from lots of guys. And, you know, I probably have done it myself over the years. And, you know, so it did toughen her spine. Her background, you know, your background's what makes you. I think, you know, I don't agree with all of her politics. You don't have to agree with her politics to understand that what she did on the floor of the House last week was a remarkable speech, and I hope, I hope that Val is right, that it leads to something more. I'm sure there are women in Congress who could probably name you multiple times when they felt bullied by their male colleagues.
And so, Dean, we'll sort of end the conversation here, but part of the reason I related to this, not just that I've experienced it because I'm a woman in politics, which seems to be a license to be as obnoxious as possible. I've also done a lot of talk radio on conservative stations, which becomes an even more egregious and toxic place to sort of attack you. But I remember one of my first jobs was as a paralegal at Daugherty, Rumble, and Butler in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And a client had asked me to do something for him. And my boss said, well, why don't you go to lunch with him? And it suddenly became obvious that I was sort of client entertainment, that's why I was being sent to lunch, because of what happened during the course of the lunch. And I remember coming back to the office and walking into the managing partner's office and shutting the door. And I said, you can fire me for this, but frankly, I want to fire you. And then I proceeded to tell him what had happened and that that's not who I was, and that no woman in his office was. That was 1976, okay? I was wet in my pants. I was terrified. It was one of my first real jobs, and I was afraid would I be blacklisted forever, but I couldn't handle it. And I couldn't just handle it for me. I kept imagining other women that would follow in my place. So that's why I see every woman relating to that, and it isn't because of the politics of the moment. And I think Val, to some extent, is very right about this, that we have to take it beyond this because it really needs to be exposed. And if Yoho gets away with it and Yoho gets to lie on the floor, and we put, you know, sort of push it under the rug as if it's a political moment, then we won't understand that it's a much bigger moment, Dean.
Yeah, and I'm interested to see where it goes from here. I mean, it was just a remarkable speech. I don't know how much of it was sketched out, how much of it was extemporaneous, but it was remarkably focused and eloquent. She didn't wander off topic at all. You know, Yoho's apology was ridiculous. It's like the proverbial interview question, what's your biggest weakness? And you say, I care too much. I work too hard. It was that kind of an apology. He's just too passionate that he can't help himself. You know, it resonated with me as a father of a daughter when she talked about how his behavior essentially gives permission to other men to treat his daughters that way. I mean, that was really a very profound thing to say. She has shown some pretty impressive political skills at various moments. You know, we talk a lot about the squad, and I think some of those individuals sometimes get a little bit pigeonholed and people just maybe tune them out. Some portion of the electorate just kind of tunes them out, says they're too strident or too ideological or too left-wing. But AOC has shown an ability to speak to a bigger audience, to kind of show some savvy thinking. And I don't think this was a calculated speech. I think she was speaking from her heart. But the current political environment is so toxic. Our discourse has been debased so significantly through, you know, the political climate, social media, et cetera, that I do have a little bit of a concern that even though it was a remarkable moment that should speak to a broader and move a broader conversation forward, that it's just somehow going to get lost in all of the noise.
Well, it's
chaos.
Right.
And we've been through this so many times. How many people have accused President Trump of a sexual assault? Two mm-hmm. dozen, maybe, mm-hmm. And nothing has happened. So I do worry about that, but it was, I started watching and I thought I would just kind of, you know, graze. And I watched the entire thing from beginning to end.
Well, I posted, I got a transcript and I posted the transcript on Facebook because I not only want people to see what she did, I wanted them to read what she did.
Yeah.
Because in a way, you know, sometimes we learn different ways and those reinforcers are important. I want you to see her. I want you to read her. I want you all those things because it was really important for us to do. And it is probably going to get somewhat lost because of the pandemic, because of going back to work, because of school, because of John Lewis, there's just a cacophony of failure happening at the same time. You know, what's going on in Portland, all the things we're going to be talking about in the next 40 minutes. But it won't be lost completely, Dean, because for a lot of us, we carry it in our head and in our heart. And you can't get lost there because I think it's going to stick. And maybe if it's not, you know, recognized for the political moment that it is, it will be recognized and it will be remembered. Ken, you wanted to make a comment?
Yeah. And that is, I wanted to add that not only is AOC's speech something that must resonate with absolutely every woman in our country and frankly on the planet.
Around the world, yeah.
Yeah, because this issue of men objectifying women and treating them with such disrespect as if, you know, they're not human beings, they don't have feelings, and I don't care about anything other than what she looks like. Objectifying women is something that every woman is used to, and failing to give women credit for being intelligent, thoughtful, people with some good ideas like AOC has, and whatever, as Dean said, whether you agree with their ideas or not, this guy can't just treat her as some effing you know what. And that is something that we all can relate to, and men too, frankly. I used to walk down the streets with my wife and men would, you know, whistle at her and holler at her and make remarks. And it was like, how dare you, you know, would you treat your own wife or your own daughter like this? And it's an attitude toward women that is so disrespectful and infuriating.
Well,
right, can I say one more? Can I add one?
Yes, Rick, please.
Because I had a thought I wanted to mention. There's a very young female legislator. I believe she was 19 or 20. When she was elected. And I remember when she first, this was 2 years ago, and she pointed out, I think on Facebook, that on her first day, she got into the elevator and there were a group of men legislators in the elevator. And they said to her, don't worry, honey, we don't bite. And it made her very uncomfortable. And she said she just felt really uncomfortable going up in that elevator with these, what should be her colleagues, her equals. And it made me think at the time, I was 19 when I was elected to the legislature. And on my first day, in the bathroom that used to be in the ante room, there was routinely a bar set up in there. And the old guys invited me in for a drink. And I felt like one of the boys on the first moment I walked into the ante room. So the different experience that I had as a 19-year-old legislator that she had 40 years later really struck home to me.
Oh, my goodness. Write that story, Rick. That's such an important story. This is what we remember. These are what we remember. All right. So I sent you an article, and the article was entitled The Essential Trade-Off. America's pandemic policy is built on choosing money over lives. So Val, the reason I wanted this is that it's like an octopus. It allows us to talk about so many things. You know, evictions are beginning right now this week. We're looking at whether they're going to extend unemployment benefits. We're looking at, you know, at the fact that there's just these incredible pockets, whether it's Texas or California, or Florida, where not only is it becoming a crisis, but what is happening is we are wearing out our healthcare system. Our doctors, our nurses are literally wearing out. So, and this doesn't just affect choices about the pandemic, it affects the entire healthcare system. I mean, people just need to understand this is not in isolation to everything else. We have the threat about schools, we have the concern about going back to college, and it is about money over life. And what is so ironic to me, and someone pointed this out, remember during the Affordable Care Act, where they refer to the death panels? Remember the death panels? And I'm thinking, Donald Trump is death. There's not even a panel. I mean, it's not even a discussion. It's kind of like walk into, you know, this ultimate failure. So as you're looking at this, how do we frame these issues so that not only do constituents understand, but you can't make a Sophie's choice over money, over life. Because in the end, you know, if you have no life, then guess what? You're not going to make the money. You're going to lose the money. You're not going to be able to spend the money. I mean, think about all those things that are so critical. And it doesn't begin with a dollar sign. It begins with a pulse, Val.
You know, I really like this article for a couple of reasons, because it was grounded in the issue of slavery and capitalism. And that reminds me of last week I was rereading the 1619 Project that the New York Times did. There was a wonderful article in there on capitalism being squarely in the camp of slavery, that capitalism really couldn't flourish without it. And so that whole idea of mammon versus morality has been there for a very long time. And what I worry about here is another generation of young people who have learned the hard lesson that the government isn't designed for them and isn't there to protect them. And that may have been the lessons that some of the liberal baby boomers had during the 1960s. If you know, there's been a lot of reference this week to 1968 and what's been happening in Portland. And in many ways, that generation was lost in their trust of government. But now we have an entire generation, regardless of their ideology, who understand that government doesn't operate in their best interest at the very base level. And you know, I think that's the burden and the primary burden that Joe Biden has if he is elected president, is that he has to turn that around and figure out how to turn that around. And these 4 years of feeling as if you have to watch out for the government because they're coming after you for whatever reason, is something that's a very hard lesson, particularly for the younger generation. And he really does need to instill some trust, you know, with all generations, but particularly with the young people who understand the difference between right and wrong, that these decisions, whether it's going back to work or going back to school, are based primarily on economics and the economy and getting it started and who benefits from that economy and all of those other things. It's one very large package that he'll need to unpack.
Rick, how do you want to respond to this? Because I mean, as I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, Mitch McConnell is maybe finally sitting down to realizing that he has to act fairly quickly on this whole idea of unemployment benefits. They're now making this suggestion that because the $600 was too rich, my middle fingers are up in stereo, when you realize that how much did Bezos make in billions in just the last 4 months? I mean, I have to say something because I'm crazy. How much of the billions that Jeff Bezos make do you think he reinvested in the economy? Just the billions he made in the last 4 months. He didn't. He put it into the market. He may have put it into some fund over in who knows Panama, but he didn't have to reinvest it. He didn't have to buy, you know, more underwear. He didn't have to pay for more housing. He didn't have, it didn't go in. But every single dime of that $600 that went into unemployment benefits, I have a funny feeling, Rick, it got plowed right back into the economy. It went right back into food stores. It went right back into the electric bill. It went right back into paying your rent. So if you really care about the economy, you don't give a crap how much Bezos made, because that money just evaporated. You care about that $600 because it actually propped up the economy for everybody else.
Of course it did. Every dollar went into the economy. And isn't it interesting that they chose $600, which if you work a 40-hour week is $15 an hour, but now they want people to get off the $15 an hour and send them back to 7.25. I mean, for Christ's sakes, you know, who the hell is are advising these people?
Exactly. And Dean, I sent you a note about a friend of mine who was out of her mind when she realized that one of the suggestions was that you could only receive 70% of what your wage was before you either got pink slipped or lost your job. And she said to me, Arnie, I will make more money than the 600. She lives in North Carolina. North Carolina and New Hampshire. North Carolina, I think the highest you can get in North Carolina for unemployment benefits, you're sitting down, $350 a week. That's the most you can get, no matter how much income you had. In New Hampshire, by the way, I think it's 420. So it's not like we're wallowing in it. The state with the highest unemployment compensation, believe it or not, is the state of Massachusetts, I think at 850. That gives you the range, all right, the range of what you get. So she did the calculation, and she said, I will be better off at the 70% than some schlub who's got 40,000, who's got kids, who's got a house. They will be making less than me because if it's going to be 70% of that 40, and knowing what North Carolina gives, which is butkus, it's going to be unbelievably disgusting when it comes to how they're going to survive. So Kenneth's telling me I have to go to a break. So let's go to a break. And then Dean, when I come back, we got to talk about these benefit things, because I don't know what's wrong with Republicans in Congress, but obviously they haven't paid a bill in years. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. We'll be right back.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. The Huntley Coal Plant in Tonawanda, New York, was once the area's biggest polluter, but it was also the town's biggest taxpayer. So when the plant was slated to close, the town was concerned about job losses, not just for company employees, but public sector workers like teachers and paramedics.
Those tax dollars that company pays goes to the folks picking up garbage and goes to the people fixing the roads and helps fund special ed.
That's Rebecca Newberry, executive director of the Clean Air Coalition of Western New York. To ease the transition, her group partnered with the town, local businesses, unions, residents, and community groups. Together, they created an economic development plan to help the town make up lost revenue over time. It's designed to grow local businesses and create new jobs, especially in manufacturing and technology. The group also helped convince the state to provide funds that fill the more immediate gap in revenue. The plant closed in 2016, and since that time,
not one public sector employee, to our knowledge, has lost their job because of the closing of this plant.
So Tonawanda has moved away from a coal-powered economy while helping protect the community. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Twin soldiers and Nixon coming. We're finally
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Dean Spiliotis joins us again from Southern New Hampshire University. Rick Newman, an old friend, a former current lobbyist and a former state legislator who started when he was 19. I didn't know this. I love that little nugget of information. And they had booze in the men's room. God, look what happened to me. Anyway, and Val Endres, a professor of political communications at Rhode Island College. So Dean, just before the break, I was like going crazy about, you know, what the Republican plan is about unemployment benefits. But I just want to give you one more little nugget of information. So someone wrote something really brilliant. And what they wrote, Dean, was that obviously these guys don't know government and they don't know how government operates and they don't know how to process checks and process them quickly. He said, you can tell that they're bankers, that they've been in the private sector. It would take them weeks to figure out the 70% of what you made last year and do the calculations and do all the stuff. All they've done is add another layer of time and delay by doing this. The beauty of the $600 was you didn't have to do extensive math. You didn't have to look back through the files. You could just send the check. And even then they were 3 and 4 weeks behind. So what this person was saying is they don't have a freaking clue to how government works.
Yeah, you know, this wouldn't be the first time in the recent series of legislative moves to deal with the coronavirus pandemic that we kind of knew going in that some of the legislative proposals were going to be problematic in their implementation. You know, the issue here is not that $600 acts as a disincentive for people to work. It's the coronavirus that acts as a disincentive for people to work. I was just reading earlier today an article about the hospitality industry, people who work as bartenders, waitstaff, hosts, hostesses, and the real, just how difficult it is now more than ever to make a living, to deal with people who are hostile about mitigation, like wearing masks and social distancing, the inability to get tips when you're making, I think it's $2.83 or so, $2.80, something like that, base wage, and then your tips are really what you live on. It's such a difficult environment. And bigger picture, going back to the beginning of this part of the conversation, the economy is only going to improve when health conditions on the ground improve. So President Trump's initial strategy of kind of wishing it away and full steam ahead on the economy, we're opening for business, it's all behind us. People instinctively know whether, not all people, but most people, instinctively know when they're at risk, when their families are facing a potential risk. We're seeing it in the debate now about school openings. But the economy is not going to significantly improve until the pandemic itself recedes from current levels of infection. So every time I hear them say, well, the $600 is an incentive for people to stay home and not work, and then I read what people are actually confronting in the workplace, particularly essential workers, hospitality workers, service workers, that's the disincentive to working, not the $600.
So Val, what they're even saying is bars and eating indoors is a super spreader event. That they actually say, the two places they say you must absolutely shut down. Numero uno, the bar. Yes. Number one, yes. The bar. Number two, in-house dining. This is exactly the group that Dean was talking about. It's just, and frankly, probably meat packing plants and chicken packing plants and all those other plants that also are super spreader events. And then let's just sort of layer this story. Let's talk about the next super spreader event, evictions. Evictions. Where the hell are they going to go? Are they going to go to a homeless shelter? Oh, that'll be a super spreader event. Are they going to go to their like grandmother's house? Well, that'll be a super spreader event. Where are they going to vote if they don't have a place to live? How do they get their absentee ballot? Well, that may be part of the issue here. So you kind of look at all these things and it's like nobody is playing it out. And you know what the hypocrisy of this is? I just got to share this nugget and then I'm tossed to you. The Republican National Committee at their office ordered $14,000 of maintenance improvements in June for the RNC headquarters. Do you know what the maintenance was? It was $14,000 worth of masks. They had ordered masks, but they could not put that down as a line item. So they called it building maintenance. So they are incredible hypocrites. They're shutting down what's happening in Florida with the Republican convention. Who knows what it's going to look like in North Carolina? They have to hide the fact that they're ordering masks and calling it building maintenance. So they live one life and the rest of us are expendable, Val.
Absolutely. And what has happened is a perfect storm in which the Trump administration wants to get the economy moving, where we know that's not possible, as Dean pointed out, and then plays on the public's boredom and attention span in many ways, and saying that it's okay because the restaurants and the bars are opened up for you to go. And again, you know, another perfect storm is that we really discount science anymore. And so those are the people that we should be looking for guidance. And instead, what we should be doing is erring on the side of caution. And what would it mean for people to be able to stay at home if they choose to stay at home, but they won't be evicted and they have money for food? So have housing security and food security. And that's what originally the CARES Act was supposed to do. And that's how your country should be operating. This is a once in a generation problem that we're having right now. And because of that, you would think that the government would be working in every possible way to keep us safe. And as we said before, people spend the money that they get. So it goes back into the economy. It is the most efficient way to get money into the economy is to give it to citizens who need it for necessities.
Well, so you know, again, it's Ford. Remember when Ford was building his cars and he suddenly realized he had to pay his workers more because he wanted his workers to be able to afford the car they were working was building.
Yes.
I mean, we learned it then. It is just, it's so obvious. And yet in this way, it's not just obvious. It is essential. It is essential for the purposes of dealing with the spread. It's essential for propping up the economy. It's the essential for making sure that there isn't, it's not even just rioting in the streets. I mean, if we're worried about Black Lives Matter and Portland, and he's trying to do a race war and he's going to protect the federal buildings, he better understand he's going to have this kind of meltdown everywhere. And I know chaos is what he wants, but I'm not sure that the Republican Party, as they play it out, want a country that basically has completely and totally not only deflated economically, but deflated politically, because this will not be a country of a democracy. This will be a country that really is a definition of instability. It's just shocking.
Well, if I can just say one more thing too, is there's untold damage done when you play on those old tropes. And that is that image of the welfare queen, that if you get your $600 a week, you're going to stay home and do nothing. And what that does is keep money out of the hands of people who need it most. And so that ends up being incredibly damaging and hurts, you know, later on when we find out we do have to give the money. Right? And people feel like that money is wasteful when it's actually helping people.
So Rick, I also sent you something when I sent out the list of topics. And again, it was another note that I got. One note was about unemployment. And then the other note was about opening schools. And what was so fascinating, and when I received it, it was like a light bulb moment. Because, you know, we're talking about colleges opening and, you know, SNU, you know, Southern New Hampshire University is going to go all online. I have law students that are going to come back home. They're going to come live with me in August. And I'm a little hysterical. I won't tell you, to be honest with you, to invite, you know, young people in. And we know that young people aren't always the most observant of the issues relating to the pandemic. But they're even nervous because they're not sure whether there's going to be a school. Will there be in class? Will it be, you know, at home, online, and should they even rent a place? Why don't they just live in Northern New Hampshire? And why are they schlepping down to Concord to even attend a school that may not be open? But Rick, one of the things I'm hearing from a lot of people is Europe, this is a very typical thing to do. They call it a gap year. And they say between high school and advanced education, a lot of kids are encouraged to do something else, to actually mature, to work, to do good, whatever it is, it's a gap year. And that it's actually beneficial. So I've been thinking, oh yeah, that's probably a really good idea for, you know, I mean, some schools may go under because if everyone decides to do a gap year, how do you keep your universities and your colleges open? But then this person made a suggestion, which I thought was fascinating. Maybe everyone should take a gap year. I mean, K through 12 take a gap year. And therefore, rather than enhance the technological divide or the wealth divide, or what do we do when, you know, half the kids are going to school Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and the other half are going Tuesday and Thursday, and how do you do a work schedule like that? Maybe we need to completely rethink this next academic year, and not just for colleges and universities, but literally for what happens with K through 12. And her suggestion was absolutely fascinating. I mean, it turns out that a lot of kids get food at school. Well, they could still go to school for food. They may not be going to school to learn about their ABCs, but they can go to school for food. There are still a lot of things that you can do using schools really more as like a super daycare than as an academic institution. And therefore, everybody will be able to get what they need and what they can't get, which is in some ways that formal education is something we all postpone together. We do this together. It's not just one school or another. It's something we do together. I thought that was just a fascinating way of approaching this very challenging next academic year.
Well, I've always thought that we seem to race through education as a parent. My child is, I can't believe it, is about to become 39, but she's got a master's degree in education and I just look back. It was like we just seem like, oh my God, no matter what happens, you can't stay back. Of course, you got to get through the third grade to the fourth to the fifth to the sixth. No, you can't take 6 months off between high school and college. And I think back on it now and think, what the hell are we in such a hurry for?
Exactly.
Now, what difference would it have made to her now at her age of 39? You know, whether she had graduated one half a year or a year later, you know, from college or got a master's degree a year later, who knows? It may have been better for her. But so I think there's probably some merit to that. There are probably people on this call that have, you know, obviously we have people here that are educational experts that know better. But I want to say one thing more about this $600 because I think it's important. I think people just can't let Trump off the hook on this. We wasted 3 months. We totally wasted 3 months because this country did not and does not have a plan. I drove back from Florida, and we go through a lot of states. Every state was different. Some places you couldn't get salt and pepper on the table. Some places you had to use plastic forks. Some places the hotels were 50%. I mean, it's ridiculous that we are a nation and we have no nationwide policy. And even going to this question you just asked about education, Trump's idea is, well, I want the schools to open, but we'll leave it to the school district. So,
but that's not even a lie, because then you got Betsy DeVos threatening to pull resources
from you if you don't go forward. So
it's just ridiculous. I mean, again, you're right. And there was that wonderful article about what Norway did right, everyone. And given the fact that I'm Scandinavian, Dean Spiliotis, I was like, I always see Norway and I go, oh, what is Norway doing? And what Norway does is something that's very hard for Americans. And that is, they have an incredibly strong sense of fraternité. They have that strong sense of community. And in Norway, when you approach a problem, it isn't how does that problem affect me? It is how does that problem affect us? And I think that that's so important, because once you have that idea that it's more important than you, then you can't argue free speech about masks or liberty about masks. You understand that if you don't wear a mask, I could get sick, you could get sick, and you don't have a right to spread your illness. Sorry, that ain't a freedom, and it isn't a liberty, and you're not thinking about everybody else. And so as I'm listening to Rick is absolutely right. We had no plan. And this is the one thing where we're kind of like, you know, we have porous borders. You know, you can't stop someone from behaving one way on the border of Rhode Island and then behaving differently in Massachusetts, because half of us work in Massachusetts but live in Rhode Island, or live in New Hampshire and work in Massachusetts. Or, you know, we do all our, what is New Hampshire known as, Dean? We're known as the shopping mall of New England. Why? We don't have a sales tax. We're this long, slender state, and virtually every shopping mall is right on the border, so that we can basically entice Maine, Massachusetts, Canada, and Vermont to shop in our state. I mean, so you can't not recognize the idea that you needed something universal here. But Donald Trump wants it both ways. He wants to threaten universally, and then he wants to burden you and say, you're on your own, Jack.
Yeah, well, for better or worse, we are the country of rugged individualists. As you were describing Norway, I was thinking, well, if we could import that, and it's a similar kind of communal culture and civic thinking in a number of Asian countries as well, where masking is just not viewed as a big deal, that would solve a lot of the problem. But the folks who don't want to wear masks see it as an invasion of the individual liberty, and that we're a country based on the idea, founded on the principles of building a society that allows us to exercise our individual liberty. So there's a real kind of the culture clash there, political clash there. But specifically on schools and teaching, you know, the problem with the gap year for everyone, I think, is that so much of kind of our pedagogical thinking is built on the idea that there are certain benchmarks that children need to achieve as they grow older, and that anytime you keep someone out of school for a year or you go to a different model, they're going to in some way, you hear a lot of talking about falling behind in their educational attainment. Ironically, at the collegiate level, I have a college student, and her and a lot of her friends have been debating about whether or not to take a gap year. And they're all going to college because they all say, well, if I took a gap year, there's nothing to do. I can't travel around the world. I can't go work in Manhattan as an intern. I can't go work at the Capitol in D.C. as an intern. I'd basically be stuck at home. And I'd rather Very take my chances on a socially distance on a college campus, wearing a mask with my peers. So gap years, I think you're seeing a number of students for a variety of reasons decide they need to take school remotely. And that's certainly a reasonable decision for some families to make and some individuals to make. But the whole gap year concept has been undercut by the fact that college students feel like there's not really any alternative. Either you go to school from home or you go take your chances on a college campus.
So you know what's interesting, Val? That's brilliant, Dean. I get that. You know, what do you do with your gap year? Your gap year was supposed to be this enrichment to travel, working for a nonprofit, working for a state senator or whatever. It even then makes more sense for the gap year for K-12. Because as she points out in her email, she says, let's call the year a wash. She goes, everybody stays back. Use the empty schools to hold neighborhood childcare. We know we're going to need childcare. Breakfast, lunch programs, structure social and physical activities for different age groups. Show movies, hold study sessions, do a variety of quasi-educational activities. Just because there are no classes doesn't mean that these kids won't be, Dean, like in college with the gap year. They're not traveling, you know? They're not going to work for a state senator. They're not going to go down to Washington, D.C. and intern. They're going to be stuck. And even if schools open, because of the variety of the schedules, because teachers are hysterical about getting sick, because parents are afraid about what are they sending their kids to, by giving them this sort of creative situation where these now empty school buildings, Val, can be used in a variety of creative ways, it might be psychologically better for the kids. It might be psychologically better for the parents. It might be better for the workplace. People will be fed when they need it. And again, people can sort of pick and choose. And it will be, in an interesting way, it'll be guilt-free. It'll be guilt-free because you know how many parents are just consumed with guilt about what they should do for their kid, what is safe, and how do I teach them when I've got to work too?
And it does make perfect sense. And particularly when we look at the fact that we have to remember that these are extraordinary circumstances. And I'm also thinking about a couple of senators who have proposed an expansion of AmeriCorps and Senior Corps. And we have very capable kids that are in 9th through 12th grade who could contribute. Imagine, for example, that they were reading to other kids online.
Right. High school core.
They could help with babysitting while parents are there. And they could have pods in neighborhoods in which they could engage in activities with them. And the same, and it may be like Dean is right that the college students are going to go to college or at least be online as we're doing at our college. But you do have a group of students and also college students who wouldn't mind engaging in that way. Right. And so here is our one opportunity in which we could do good. And we could have spent the summer organizing on how we could do good.
Oh my God. I mean, I read her comments and then I saw the article about the gap year and I'm like, oh my God. I mean, I'm going to go back to you, Rick, because one of the things that Fauci said, and you kind of almost referenced it, is that we didn't have a plan for months. And Fauci was begging for a plan. And Fauci said, if you think it's extreme, go beyond it, because it's probably not extreme. I don't know how many times he said it. You know, I can tell you the worst case story. Imagine it worse than what I'm telling you. And given what Fauci was doing, he was begging us to really sort of work together as a nation, because just because Texas didn't have it when New York had it didn't mean Texas wasn't going to get it. Talk to doctors in Houston right now, okay? Just because New York had it didn't mean that Florida wasn't going to get it. Talk to people in Florida right now. So what we understood was this virus doesn't have any respect for borders. If we didn't do something as 50 states, we were going to get screwed, and we didn't do something as 50 states. But as I'm looking at this whole idea about what to do with education, this really is the kind of thing where we could, and I mean, there's an emotional piece here. And Noval said this isn't going to go on in perpetuity, but there is an emotional piece here and a level of emotional guilt about what to do, that if you give people an interesting choice, but the choice really sort of reflects their lives and what schools can offer, but not necessarily the academics, it actually fills in the interstices between the cracks of what's now being enhanced by what Donald Trump is doing with his threats and with his orders.
It's beyond, I've thought a great deal about this because I really haven't had a whole lot else to do. And the brilliant political move, which he's not capable of, but would have been for him 3 months ago to introduce Dr. Fauci to the world and say he's in charge. Do what he says, and we're going to take take advice from him. Now, if things failed, he blames
him.
If it goes well, he gets the credit. So, but he couldn't let himself do that. He had to be the guy standing there saying, "Drink bleach and try to stick a fluorescent light up your butt to get rid of it." I mean, he's not capable of just doing the right thing for the right reason. That's just a simple fact.
So, but God, you're brilliant, Rick. It's just, you nailed it. But it's like, so is it that he can't do the right thing, or the right thing offends him, Dean? He is a man who thrives on chaos. He is a man who actually, if it's true, he rejects it. If it's a lie, he embraces it. I mean, just think about it. If you have a toxic portfolio, he wants you in his cabinet. If you're a good man and a patriot, he wants you to leave. There's a sickness here that we keep thinking that he will understand what the right thing is, but I actually think he doesn't value the right thing.
Yeah, I don't think he's functioning in a world where he sees any sort of moral absolutes, or there's any kind of guiding set of overarching principles. Everything is tactics. Everything is reactive. It's usually driven by whatever psychological need he's responding to at the moment, which is typically feeling insecure about something, whether it's his intelligence or his appearance or his manliness or what have you. It's a very kind of tactical, instrumental, amoral type of decision-making. I've long since have given up looking for any kind of overarching strategy or guiding principles or really anything. I mean, he makes decisions in the moment. He does not do a good job of processing and incorporating new and conflictual information into his decision-making calculus. And I find it all very, very reactive. There was, you know, for a long time, there was talk about how he was playing three-dimensional chess and, you know, all the sorts of brilliance. He's very transparent and he's very reactive. I find it very easy to predict what he's going to say or do at a given moment, because it's all based on these kinds of in-the-moment calculations. So you can just look at what's going on at the moment. You can kind of figure out how he's going to react.
Yeah, he's not playing one-dimensional checkers.
Playing one-dimensional checkers. So I'm going to leave you with the last word, Val. So as we look at all this, there was a wonderful article that I also sent you that said, if we're going to talk about safety in the workplace, maybe we should have workers that make that decision, not employers. Because employers will make a decision that sometimes benefits their bottom line, and guess who's expendable? Maybe we should let workers do what they think is important, because they want to work, but they want to live.
It's that whole idea of individualism and rugged individualism versus a communal sense that we can't get the workers together. And I think the American public, despite what's happening in politics, the majority of them understand the risks that are involved here. And if they go to work, they understand those risks. It should be, you know, an issue of freedom of choice. But I want to go back a little bit to what Rick had to say here, is that we have leadership that has so much power, but yet they get to play the victim. And that's the real problem, in that they can't get beyond that whole sense of victimage to see what's better for other people.
What a great STEM wonder. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for, again, such an interesting Rethink the Week. Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Rick Newman, my favorite lobbyist, and Val Endres, professor of political communication at Rhode Island College, and of course, Ken Barnes, my producer. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao. Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land where I'm bound. Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land where I'm bound. Where